Setlist in association with 7Digital.
This week, Taylor Swift's Secret Folklore and Shaken Off lawsuits. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me, it's Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
As ever, we are going to be taking a look back through some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week. A week when, very sadly, Q Magazine announced that its next issue will be its last.
And this time, it really will. Because
yes.
At one point, they thought that the last issue was going to be the last. Then it wasn't. But the next issue is. So we talked about this in quite some detail on a recent edition of Setlist, which is why we didn't think we should spend that much time talking about it this week. But yeah, the editor of Q took to Twitter to confirm that despite hopes that current owners Bauer Media might be able to find somebody else to buy Q and keep it going as a going concern, they haven't managed to do that. And so therefore, Q Magazine, just like its sister title, Planet Rock Magazine, they are ending. It's all to do with the ongoing challenges facing music media and then a whole load of COVID-19 stuff piled on top, all of which we talked about in quite some detail, as I said, on a recent edition of Setlist when we looked at the challenges facing the magazine sector with a little bit of COVID in there as well. So maybe for those people who are new to Setlist and don't remember that debate, because you're new, so you wouldn't remember it because you weren't there.
You can't remember something you have no awareness of.
So people who are new who never heard it, and people who are forgetful, who did listen to it but have forgotten it, Andy will put a link back to that edition in the notes so that you can go and read that there. But yes, and I mean, it was interesting, wasn't it? I mean, a lot of artists and industry people on Twitter, well, it's a bit like the various times when HMV has almost gone under, or has gone under, but not quite disappeared from the high street, that a magazine that I think perhaps in the 2000s would have had quite a lot of criticism is feeling an awful lot of love now that it's closing down, which I think is partly because of, well, some people would say that it had a particularly good era editorially in the last couple of years, and also, like HMV, was kind of seen as the last of the big retailers, Q is sort of seen as the last of the big glossy monthly magazines. So lots of people paying tribute to the magazine and expressing dismay that it was no longer going to be publishing.
Yes, it is sad. I mean, it's one of those things. I mean, similar to when the NME's print magazine, well, at different stages of the NME's print magazine changing or shutting down. And in fact, when it was revamped at one point as well, it had a lot of love from the industry, but it did not have the readership really necessary to keep it going long term. And obviously the COVID-19 pandemic has accelerated the difficulties that already were in place in the print media industry, and has seen quite a lot of magazines go under in this time. And it's sad that Q had to be one of them, especially as there were attempts to save it. But yeah, the latest issue, which is out this week as the podcast comes out, I think it's a big retrospective of the history of the magazine. So a really good time to get into it if you haven't read Q before.
But we ought to point out that is not what we're here to talk about this week.
No, this week we are going to be talking about the many digital deals that controversial online music platforms TikTok and Spotify have been doing in the last week or so. But first, let's talk about Taylor Swift. Taylor Swift has a new album out, which I think everyone knows now, but just a few days ago, very, very few people knew because she didn't announce it until Thursday night, hours before it was due to arrive.
Yes, so just as New Music Friday, as I think we still call it, was about to begin, Taylor Swift took to her social media to remind her fans that quite a lot of what she had got planned for this summer hasn't happened, because there were shows, weren't there? And the shows got cancelled because of COVID-19. But she said, although a whole load of stuff that she'd got planned for the spring and the summer have not been able to happen, because she's been confined to her home, she's been making lots of music and writing lots of songs and doing lots of quite interesting collaborations. So much so that there's a full album made. And yes, as of Friday, that album is available from all your favourite album sourcing sources.
Certainly the online ones anyway, because Taylor Swift's all in on streaming now.
She is. She's now fully embracing the streaming. And then I think there's about 87,000 different versions that you can buy direct to fan off her website if you'd like physical. But obviously, maybe you're still not able to get to a physical record shop, depending on where you live in the world.
So the album is called Folklore, and as you said, it's got some interesting collaborations on it. The bulk of the album was co-written and produced by The National's Aaron Dessner. It's also got a collaboration with Bon Iver's Justin Vernon on there, Jack Antonoff's on there because he's on everything, and also a mysterious character called William Bowery, who... there are many fan theories about who that is. It's either her boyfriend, her brother, or... wildcard, Joni Mitchell.
Yes, so that was the fans speculating wildly on social media as to who that mysterious collaborator could be once that list had been confirmed. But as you said, definitely the primary collaborator here is Aaron Dessner, who has also taken to social to talk about the project. In fact, he collaborated so much on this record, it almost feels like it's kind of a double act release, although officially it's a Taylor Swift record.
Yes, but I think his mark is definitely firmly stamped on the record. I've listened to it a couple of times now. We're recording this Friday morning, so I've only had a chance to listen to it a couple of times, but I listened to it twice back to back because it's a really good album. I mean, I really like The National and I really like Taylor Swift, so it's a pretty perfect match for me. And his mark is definitely on it, and Taylor Swift's mark is definitely on it, to the point that actually in the Bon Iver track, although he's very distinctive in his performance, he's singing words where you think Taylor Swift definitely wrote those words. But yeah, it's a great album. It's a really cohesive album.
Well, I suppose that's interesting, isn't it? Because as we say, this album has been written during lockdown when Taylor Swift suddenly had all of his extra time on her hands, which means that these collaborations have been happening at a distance.
Yes.
And by the sounds of it, because as I say, Aaron Dessner has also posted on social about the project, it kind of began with a random exchange of messages between the two of them that he thought might lead to some random collaboration that maybe one day would result in a song that one of them would do, but almost immediately they became a little bit of a music making machine.
Yeah, he said that Taylor Swift had approached him in late April about maybe writing some songs together. He then goes on, I had been isolating with my family but writing a ton of music in the first months of quarantine, which I shared. I thought it would take a while for song ideas to come, and I had no expectations as far as what we could accomplish remotely. But a few hours after sharing music, my phone lit up with a voice memo from Taylor of a fully written version of a song. The momentum never really stopped. And it does really sound like an album that was written in a kind of a really creative moment. The songs are quite personal. It sounds like lyrics are written sort of in the moment as the thoughts occur. And so they seem very personal, a lot of the songs, but they're really well crafted. Actually, it made me think of, do you remember when Ryan Adams recorded an entire cover album of 1989 and like put it out and went, look, when you play these songs on an acoustic guitar, they're actually really good songs. Even though, I mean, 1989 is an almost perfect album. But partly because of the speed at which it's written, I guess, and partly because of the way it's been produced, it really focuses on the songs and the quality of Taylor Swift's songwriting. They are just a collection of really good songs, and it contrasts particularly with her previous album, Lover, where I think you could argue, I certainly would argue, that she'd sort of gone off the boil a little bit, because Lover was a very long album with about, I don't know, the first 10 tracks, good album, following 8 tracks, not good. It's not, I don't understand why they're on that album. Whereas this is 16 tracks and it's over in a flash. It's that's why I listened to it twice, because it finished and I was like, I wasn't finished listening to that yet, so I put it on again. It's very good. Look at me being all positive about stuff. I thought CMU was supposed to be cynical.
Yeah, and you were quite positive about the Mercury shortlist as well. I don't know what's going on. It must be the...
except that one act.
Apart from the one act that you don't approve of being shortlisted for the Mercury Prize.
Yeah, and as with my write-up of the story, I'm not going to say who that act is, but... oh, it's not often I hate bands these days, but that one band is on the Mercury's... oh, I just don't like them.
So what you're saying is you are really glad that when Taylor Swift suddenly had all of this spare time because of COVID and everything being shut down, that she invested that time into doing something new and some interesting collaborations and creating a new record, rather than perhaps using all that sudden spare time to pursue her ongoing vendetta with former label Big Machine and re-recording, as she has pledged to do, all those old albums so that when she's contractually allowed to, she can re-release them and stop people from buying those records and streaming those records from Big Machine to benefit its new owner, Scooter Braun. So you're pleased she went for positive new collaborations rather than pursuing vendetta with all the free time created by COVID.
Yeah, and I think this and probably things like the Charlie XCX album, which, you know, she created in 5 weeks at the beginning of lockdown and put out really quickly, show that pop music can really benefit from being made in the moment and put out quickly, rather than, as often happens, it kind of gets agonized over and run past lots of people and bits are tweaked and changed for what is perceived to be maximum impact. And this really feels like an album that was just made and put out, and it really benefits from that, I think.
Now, if you are a regular listener to Setlist or a regular reader of the CMU Daily, or both, and all this positivity coming out of Andy Malt's mouth is disturbing you.
disturbing me.
Let's pump a little bit of cynicism back into our coverage of this. Because, of course, whenever there's a new Taylor Swift album coming out, you might get excited about the music and the songwriting and all of that. I'm interested in two things. First of all, how many trademark applications will now be filed? Because whenever Taylor brings out an album, she always trademarks all of the song titles and key lyrics, because somewhere somebody is thinking, oh, that lyric could be a perfume and that title could be a fashion line. I mean, Taylor Swift really has taken the trademark side of being an artist to a level never seen before.
Yes.
And then, of course, the other thing I'm interested in is, once this record's out there, is how many lawsuits will be filed by artists and songwriters claiming that she's ripped off one of their records, even though they did this in lockdown, sharing files over the internet. But, you know, somewhere I'm certain there's an artist who will be saying, ah, what Taylor Swift was really doing during lockdown was watching lots of videos on YouTube, including my video, and that's how she managed to rip off my song on this song. So we will be watching closely the trademark registry in the US and the courts in the US for the trademark registrations and all the litigation, because we have to have a little bit of cynicism here at CMU. Although it has to be said, if there is a lawsuit pending because someone's going to accuse Taylor Swift of ripping off their track on this new album, well, she got rid of one of them last week. So there is some room in her lawyer's diary to be focusing on that if and when it happens.
Yes, this was a lawsuit brought against her by Jesse Graham over the song Shake It Off from the previously mentioned 1989 album. Not the only lawsuit related to that song, but this is possibly the more amusing one. He claimed that she had lifted lyrics from his 2013 song Haters Gonna Hate. His lyrics were, haters gonna hate, haters gonna hate, players gonna play, players gonna play, which he reckons are very similar to, cause the players gonna play, 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 and the haters gonna hate, 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 hate. It's a clear rip-off, is what he said, not once, but a number of times, because we've gone through a lot of stages of this court case, so many now that the judge is getting a little bit pissed off with him.
Yeah, so this guy, Jesse Graham, first sued in 2015, alleging that Shake It Off, which had been released the previous year, ripped off his song, as you say, Haters Gonna Hate, which was released in 2013. The case was pretty quickly dismissed by the court, the judge basically saying there isn't a strong enough argument here for any case for copyright infringement. He then had various goes at refiling the case. I think it was on third try, the case was dismissed again, this time with prejudice, which is basically a judge's way of saying, I'm dismissing this and you're not allowed to bring it back. That's it. We're not going to hear this case again. Meanwhile, you mentioned that this isn't the only lawsuit in relation to this song or even in relation to this lyric. So after Jesse Graham had sued, two other songwriters called Sean Hall and Nathan Butler also sued. They also claimed that the player's gonna play, 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 hate's gonna hate, hate, hate line was a rip-off, this time of their song from 2001. So a much older song called Player's Gonna Play. So they also sued, saying that that was copyright infringement. That case also got dismissed. And in that case, the judge, seeing it, different judge, said that writing lyrics about players playing and haters hating was too banal for those words to be protected by copyright, was basically what the judge said. But that then went to the Ninth Circuit Appeals Court. So once it got to the appeals court stage, this other case started to get quite a lot more media coverage. And the Ninth Circuit actually overturned that ruling and said that it wasn't for the judge to decide whether or not singing about players playing and haters hating was so banal that there was no copyright in those lyrics, and the jury should have made that decision. So that whole case has now been sent back so a jury can consider it. And on the back of that, Jesse Graham decided, I'm going to have another go at suing over this. But because on the third round, his case had been dismissed with prejudice, for this fourth attempt, he sued through his company rather than as an individual. So that then resulted in a response from Taylor Swift's lawyers almost immediately saying, hang on, that's a sneaky ruse. This is just the same case. You're just doing it with your company rather than in your own right so that you can have another go. Surely that's playing the system. And anyway, we have all of these issues with the arguments. There were some technicalities around copyright registration. So Taylor Swift's team basically presented most of the same arguments, which, given it had worked three times previously, was probably a sensible strategy. And for the fourth time, the judge has dismissed the case and had some quite stern words to say about Jesse Graham for pursuing this action for a fourth time.
Yeah, while noting that Graham hadn't really dealt with the issues relating to Taylor Swift's response to this lawsuit, the judge also criticised Graham for several instances of misconduct, including the allegation that he'd fraudulently added the name of a law firm to his most recent court filing to make it look like his company had hired legal representation. And dismissing this latest case added that the alleged misconduct, along with the prior three identical cases, raised the issue of whether Graham is a vexatious litigant.
Yeah, that's always a good phrase, isn't it?
I like it.
It comes up in various jurisdictions. It's basically the idea of people who just keep pursuing more and more lawsuits against people, particularly the same people again and again. And it's sort of seen as an abuse of the system almost by going legal constantly out of a vendetta. And actually, this case is being pursued for the Californian courts. And in California, if you are formally labelled as a vexatious litigant by the courts, you actually end up on a list. And what it means is, every time you subsequently file a lawsuit in the courts in California, you basically have to get the approval of a judge or another official in the court to even pursue the legal action. So there's an extra hurdle you have to cross every time you file another lawsuit. So Graham wasn't actually added to that list in this scenario, but basically what the judge was saying is, it's kind of your last warning. If you keep pursuing this through my court, I'm going to add you to that list, and that will cause problems for you in the future. Although it has to be said that the American legal profession website Law360 spoke to Graham after that judgment had been passed, and he said he was planning on appealing that ruling. So there may as yet be a yet another final chapter to this. So maybe I was wrong in saying that Taylor Swift's lawyers have some extra time on their hands to be dealing with any new plagiarism claims that will be incoming. But I'm almost certain there'll be some, so they'll have to clear some space in their diary some other way.
And finally, this week, as I mentioned earlier, there have been various new digital licensing deals done in the last week. Spotify signed a big new licensing deal with Universal, in which it was very nice about Universal. And TikTok, the controversial TikTok, has signed deals with Believe and the National Music Publishers Association in the US.
Yes, and obviously, these days, licensing deals between record companies and music publishers and collecting societies and streaming services, they're being signed all the time. We report on them frequently in CMU. Actually, quite often, we just stick them in the one-liners news in brief column because they are so frequent. But we thought we would mention at least a couple of these new deals this week because they are interesting. So I suppose if we start off with Universal's new deal with Spotify. So the deals that any label, publisher, etc. does with a service like Spotify, they come up for renewal every 2 to 3 years. When the major labels' deals are up for renewal, everyone starts speculating as to what might happen. Because obviously, what has happened over the last 10, 12 years that Spotify has been in business is every time Spotify renegotiates its deals with anybody, but particularly the major record companies, Spotify's negotiating hand becomes stronger. And in some ways, Spotify's entire business was built on that. In the early days, it was really hard getting licensing deals like the ones that Spotify needed. They were incredibly expensive. They required big upfront advances. And those first few deals, Spotify gave nearly everything, not quite, but nearly everything away to the music industry in order to get those deals in place. But in doing so, it spent a lot of money, but in doing so, it got itself a position in the market where it is now globally the market-leading premium streaming service. Yes, Apple and Amazon are coming up behind, but I mean, it really is the dominant premium streaming service on a global basis. So Spotify's assumption was every time we renegotiate these deals, every time we regroup, we are going to be a stronger negotiating partner. We get to the point where actually Universal needs Spotify more than Spotify needs Universal, and then we'll get much more favourable terms. And that has slowly been happening. So that's why people are interested when these deals come up for renewal, and particularly when the major label deals come up for renewal. You mentioned how in the official announcement of the Universal deal, Spotify was gushing about Universal, which
was all a bit over the top,
which was interesting. I mean, also gushing to the extent that it would piss off all of their other licensing partners. They were saying that Universal was the innovator in music and you know, had always embraced things first. I mean, if I look back to the late 2000s, there were various points in the history of digital music where different majors were the early adopters and different companies were the holdouts. There was a period where Warner was the holdout. But then Warner were the first to do the YouTube deal. But I think when Spotify were doing their original deals in the late 2000s, Universal was going through a period of being much more receptive to new business models. But actually, in amongst all of the gushing nonsense in this press release that Spotify put out, it talks a lot about Universal having priority access to the new marketing tools that Spotify is building, the new ways that Spotify are allowing labels to push their new releases and their artists to subscribers, many of which are basically paid services, they're advertising services. And so if we want to stick with the cynical thing, given that we spent the first 15 minutes being really nice about Taylor Swift, who is signed to Universal these days, I don't know, there's part of me when I read what Daniel Ek from Spotify and Lucian Grange from Universal were saying, almost in this press release, it kind of felt like they were saying, we're going to give Universal, well, they were saying, because Universal's an innovator, Universal are going to have all of our marketing tools first so that they can test them and give us feedback. That's how it was positioned. But if you wanted to be cynical, just for a moment, you could say, well, actually, is this press release saying, I don't know this, this is me speculating, but is it basically saying Universal has had to accept another slight cut when it comes to things like the revenue share part of this deal? But in return for that, they're being given priority access to all of Spotify's new marketing gadgets, so that although Universal's rev share might go down slightly, their consumption share will go up when it comes to the digital pie. So that although they may be getting slightly less on rev share, or maybe the minimum guarantees are coming down, more of their music will be consumed and therefore they'll still see as much money coming through. I don't know. As I say, that's a wild speculation, but with my cynical hat on, that's how I read this press release, which is we're giving the biggest music company in the world priority access to our marketing nonsense so that more people listen to Drake and Taylor Swift and Universal's priority artists. I don't know.
And the other company doing digital deals on music licensing last week was TikTok. And the big one of those was with the US National Music Publishers Association, which, I mean, is big news because until quite recently, the NMPA was threatening to sue TikTok for not having proper licenses agreed. Because back in April, NMPA boss David Israelite told the Financial Times that he estimated that at least half of the music publishing sector was yet to agree deals with TikTok, even though their songs were being included in videos uploaded by the platform's users. And that is why he was saying that it could result in litigation. However, last week, the trade body said that it had finalised a deal with TikTok to offer eligible NMPA members a new valuable revenue stream. This new partnership will give NMPA members the ability to opt in to a licensing framework that allows them to benefit from their works, including on TikTok, and it is effective retroactively as of 1st of May 2020. Israelite himself said, "We are pleased to find a way forward with TikTok which benefits songwriters and publishers and offers them critical compensation for their work. Music is an important part of apps like TikTok which merge songs with expression and popularise new music while also giving new life to classic songs. This agreement respects the work of creators and gives them a way to be paid for their essential contributions to the platform." And I suppose that's acknowledging the fact that TikTok has kind of become a machine for making tracks go viral, so you don't want to put it out of business. But also, the publishers would like to get paid for their music being used so heavily on the platform. Obviously, it comes at a time when TikTok is controversial in other ways too, with the talk of it sending data back to the Chinese government. But clearly, that's not getting in the way of it doing its deals. As I said, it also had to deal with Believe and its DIY distribution service TuneCore in the last week. So that's more on the court recording side of things. But clearly, all that controversy is not getting in the way of those deals at the moment. But that is all we've got time for on this episode of Setlist. Do remember to like, share, rate, subscribe, review, all of those things. That list is getting longer. And if you have any questions or comments about anything we've discussed on this week's episode, email us setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. You can find links to everything we've discussed in the show notes at setlistpodcast.com. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Malt and Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Setlist is an Unlimited production.